one of the challenges of the life I live is that it's I'm pretty hard to pin down. And I apologized to Bob yesterday because he had sent... Thank you. There we go. He had sent... Let me see if we get... Okay, there. No more feedback. He had sent several emails to me. And I don't know how it happened, but everybody who knows that they're supposed to reach me always has to send a copy to one or two people on my staff, depending on what the thing is about. And that's how it gets to me. Because I get about 250 emails a day. The vast majority are unsolicited. And there's no way I can read them all. Just impossible. And when I travel, which I do half the time, it means there's 250 that built up from yesterday, so today it's 500. You get the problem, right? So Bob was trying to reach me. I didn't know it. I felt terrible. And we finally connected yesterday. I apologized to him, and I said, you're really a patient guy. So I want to congratulate Bob for living one of the truths I know, which is that infinite patience produces immediate results. So the other thing I'm going to say before I get started with this, I got a couple preliminary comments to make. One of them has to do with my biography. So I have an impossible to understand biography. So don't try to make sense of it in any kind of normal fashion, because it doesn't make sense in a normal fashion. The key to my biography is the thing that Bob alluded to. I absolutely fundamentally believe and have my entire adult life lived on the principle that what we're here to do is to ask, how can I serve? And when you do that, you get these interesting answers. And then you just follow. So it's a combination of left brain intelligence and right brain, if you will, intuition. And when you have the two working together, it cuts like a pair of scissors. And what I'm always telling my business audience is, don't just trust your left brain. That's only one blade or one tine of the scissor. And one tine of a scissor is not half a scissors, it's a broken knife. It doesn't cut properly. So if you're trying to live your business world from merely the left brain linear projection of data, you will fail. Now, you may succeed for a while, it may even look like you're a great success. Sooner or later, you will fail. If you come at it from merely intuition, and you have no intention of cross-checking that with what the feedback of the external world is giving you, you will be living a life of either incredible asceticism, the life of a very holy man or woman, or you will be very confused. And if you don't know which one of those two you are, it's really discouraging, because from that place it's hard to figure out. So what I like to share with people is, there's nothing about what I do that is that extraordinary in the ultimate sense. What's extraordinary, which everybody's capable, and it doesn't matter what age chronologically we're at today, because every day is a new opportunity to shift and to see yourself with that pair of scissors and approaching life with both the left brain and the right brain acting in concert. Now, I wanted to start with that thought for a couple reasons. First of all, it's because of the way that Stephen wrote the book. So the book is a left brain elucidation, right, of a lot of things, chapter by chapter, that Stephen thinks would be good solutions. And you're going to hear today that, and I know Stephen extremely well for many years, and I'm grateful he wrote this book. And some of his solutions, frankly, are just not right. I'll mention a few today. Because it's not the key issue behind this book. The key issue is, he's saying, can you come at life with a spiritual dimension? And if you can't, here are some practical solutions for how it might look. Well, he doesn't have to be right with his practical solutions. What he's really doing is urging a methodology, a way to approach challenges. And for that, his book is a success. So that he doesn't know what I know about economics or law or business or other things doesn't really matter. If he can get the conversation started, what he's really saying is, use the scissors. Right? Don't just look at these problems with a fundamental left-brain approach, because that might not get you the solution. In fact, if you just looked at these issues with a fundamental left-brain approach, you would have a world that looks like today, and I'm not happy with the world I'm in right now. Now, I'm happy with how far we have come, but I am not happy with where we've chosen to stop. And I really think we have to accelerate the progress. And I'll explain what that means in a moment. So that was my first little... I want to acknowledge Stephen for what he did. He's the one who sent me to speak on this stuff. He's the one to call Bob, I guess. And I'm happy to do it because this is what I love to do, is to help people integrate information that can be useful to them and their communities. But that doesn't mean everything in the book is right. Now, this wasn't intended to be a scientific book. When I write books that are extremely heavily footnoted. And if they inspire, they inspire because the information inspires you. So, for the most part, the books I'm famous for are extremely heavy manuscripts of really detailed stuff. There's over 1,000 footnotes in my last book. In the college textbook I did for Simon & Schuster years ago, it was like in the hundreds and hundreds, I forget. Because when you write a textbook, you owe it to the students to be accurate, to be fully informative, and to give them the trail you went down so they can then cross-check that trail for themselves. That's what you do when you write college textbooks. When you write heavy manuscripts on renewable energy for the energy industries, you have to be extremely detailed and has to be very specific and very factual and, frankly, very left brain. But the book itself, in this particular case, was called Freedom from Idiot Soil, was a right brain exercise. And where I had the most fun, frankly, with that book was the chapter headings. I really had a ball with that, because the first chapter on climate change is Cloudy with a Chance of Chaos. And the chapter on nuclear, chapter 5, was Nuclear, Mistake in Search of a Mission. So I do things like that. And that's just to keep people awake so they'll turn to the chapter, but then it gets kind of like it goes through this very left-brain approach. I have written books that are more inspirationally oriented. And one of them, which we did a number of years ago at the and I turned it into a course that was taught at Stanford Business School, and then eventually at the University of Michigan, and I believe at Harvard and Kellogg. So the top business schools in the world started using this textbook a number of years ago, and it was more inspirational. And it was called New Paradigms in Business. So what does the new business model look like? And that type of an approach was much more of what I like to do, because the audience for me there was to inspire students and business people to come from a different place. So that's not heavily footnoted. Now, I share that with you because this book is more of the latter than the former. So I don't want you to make it wrong because it doesn't do what a college textbook does. That's not what it was intended to do. And I think Marianne Williamson hit that real well in her foreword, that what Stephen's doing is trying to inspire us to think a different way, to attack these issues a different way. And in that sense, it's not about the accuracy of any specific idea. It's more about, can you get into this mindset? Can you get into this belief that we can create a sacred, in fact, we have a sacred America. Can we honor it? Third comment I want to make at the outset. One of the chapters I was given, which was chapters 19, 20, 21, and 22, one of them had a quote by Rice and Gorbachev. And it's the one called Ending Global Warming. And I had the good fortune to know Rice very, very well for a long time. Because when the Soviet Union was, before the Soviet Union started to collapse for about 15 years, I was involved in a program out of Esalen called the Russian-American Exchange Program. And our job during the Reagan years was to keep a back door open to the Russian government, because at that point they were at the point of, you know, the Cold War was at its height. And so with the Reagan government's permission, we had this whole citizen diplomacy thing, it was called, where we would go back and forth with individual citizens in the Soviet Union and America. And in that process, I did a bunch of things that came to Mikhail Sergeyevich, is his attention. Mikhail Sergeyevich is his name, Gorbachev. Several things came to his attention that I did because I wanted to help. And in those days, it had a lot to do with initially he wanted me to set up what was then called a space bridge, what we now call basically just an internet phone call. But in those days, you had to rig up a very elaborate system to be able to broadcast Gorbachev into the U.S. and the U.S. back to Gorbachev using satellite technology. And I had a history of satellite technology, so they asked me to do it. I did it, and he was very grateful. Then as things progressed and deteriorated in Russia, he ended up asking me to help with one of his personal missions in the Soviet Union, which was to help the orphans. The Russian orphanage system was extremely terrible. Okay, so let me define terrible. Terrible is not just that you don't have enough to eat, not just that you get brutalized because you did. It's that they were looked at as arms of communist Russia. And so a person, a child growing up in an orphanage, was stamped for the rest of their life to get the dirtiest jobs, the worst jobs. And the reason is because they only knew one mother, and it was Mother Russia. So they had no family. And as a result, they were basically expendable. And I could tell you stories of what they did with those orphans that would turn your stomach. Gorbachev had a terrible, terrible thing with that. And he wanted to change that. And so one of the first jobs he gave me was to airlift five C5A loads of blankets and hypodermic syringes and vitamins and things to Russian orphanages when they were all collapsing at the point of the collapse of the Soviet Union. And we did that. And that was very successful. And when it was over, he and three others of us had this conversation. How are we going to go from the collapse of Russia to a new world configuration with the Cold War ended? And so we decided, and he agreed, we would form a thing called the Gorbachev Foundation, which still exists, although it's kind of deteriorated over time now. And so the first 4 years, I and these three other people started a foundation. In fact, one of them you might know is the former senator, Alan Cranston, was one of the four of us. It was a very interesting group. Very interesting group. And we started this foundation, and it's a long story, I won't go into it. We secured the Presidio of San Francisco, the Commandant's House, and we got them to donate it to us for the headquarters of the foundation. And the reason was, the Presidio was a Russian fur trading post, originally. And we wanted the symbolism that the Commandant's House of the Presidio, which is the oldest continuous fortified place in America, we wanted that to symbolize that once they came in trade, and now they come in peace again. And so we were able to convince the U.S. Park Service to give us that particular spot, and it became the headquarters of the Gorbachev Foundation. And through all those years of dealing with orphans and then the Gorbachev Foundation, I got to know Raisa. And I want to share with you something very important about Raisa that most people don't know. Here's Gorbachev, who came up through KGB. Because everybody had to come through KGB. Now, there's two levels of KGB. There's the killer version, that's where Putin comes from. And then there's the lawyer division, which runs the society for the Communist Party. And Gorbachev came up to the lawyer side. He was a lawyer. And he never got involved with dark ops and that kind of thing. He was totally on the other side of the room. But then he came up through that, and that they actually put him the head of it, and then he became the premier. So he was elected, in effect, to be the second most powerful person in the world for life. And some of you are old enough to remember, it was unheard of that a Russian dictator would ever be retired normally. As the joke was, they had a horizontal retirement plan. You left on a slab or you didn't leave at all. And by the way, I'm going to digress. I absolutely love Gorbachev. I think he was probably the greatest human being in the last century, male. The greatest female was Mother Teresa, in my mind. But he was the greatest male. And Gorbachev, I once got to ask him privately, what was the absolute worst thing that happened while you were premier of Russia? What do you think was the worst thing that happened on your watch? And he didn't hesitate long. He said, Chernobyl. And he said, I did a terrible thing. I believed my own scientists. And it wasn't for 5 days that I realized what had happened. And I didn't believe the people in Northern Europe telling us there was a cloud of radiation over them. And he became an anti-nuclear crusader after that. And if you look at our book on nuclear from 1997 that we did for Simon Schuster, you'll see he's one of the endorsements. But the foreword was written by my close friend Ralph Nader. And the point of that book was, by the way, I'm the only business guy alive who can say my close friend is Ralph Nader. And get away with it. The point of that is that Gorbachev was quick to identify where he had failed his own people and the world. I asked him, what's the greatest thing that you accomplished during the time you were premier? And without hesitating, he said, during the entire time I was premier, not one drop of Russian or foreign blood was ever shed in the world. Now, if you go back and check that, you'll find they weren't at war anywhere in the world. He stopped war. And as you know, he unwound the communist system with perestroika. So he took what was a guaranteed job for life, second most powerful person, and he voluntarily stepped down. It's an amazing story. And how he did that and how he was able to do that is a thriller better than anything that Tom Clancy ever wrote. In this process, I got to know Raisa. Everybody who understood Gorbachev knew he was extremely smart, and he was a very powerful guy. He was extremely effective. But that's not how he figured out that he needed to unwind the Soviet Union. Because he was KGB, he had an unrestricted right to take any book from the West he wanted and read it. And his wife, Raisa, came across a book by Abraham Maslow, The Hierarchy of Needs. And she started reading it. And she said, Sergeyevich, this is pretty good stuff. You feed people at this level, then they go to the next level. We got to make a little problem feeding people. And so she encouraged him to start reading Maslow. She then started reading a lot of stuff from the Association of Humanistic Psychology, AHP. So the Association of Humanistic Psychology is the field populating the books that today you would find Maslow and the rest of them in. And she kept bringing those books back. And what she bought was the belief that these books spelled out something about the essence of the West that they couldn't see in Russia, because all they could see was what was broken with the West. So in today, in the Muslim culture, in many parts of the world, they cannot see what works in America. All they can see is what's broken. And Raisa, because she had this unique position, she was the one who actually did the missionary work, went and figured it out. She trained Gorbachev. He was, no question, he admitted it from the get-go. I know what I know because Raisa went and found out for me. He worshipped Raisa. And she was more than a partner. She was his muse. She was his tutor. In all of that, she was also a very, very vulnerable woman. So she was, if you will, that left brain's countercheck. She was the intuitive. She was drawn by a spiritual principle. She was feminine, and at a time when the patriarchy was in full ascent. And that was what gave us the ability to end the Cold War. Now, not many people know that, because you either had to know Raisa, or you had to know Gorbachev, or more like you had to know both, pretty intimately, to know that. So if there are questions in the Q&A you want to talk about how that all happened, and how we got to where we are today, it wasn't an accident. Two incredibly dedicated human beings planned it, and they pulled it off. Unfortunately, in the coup that captured Gorbachev and Raisa, after they unleashed the Soviet Union and turned it into the Russian Federation, as you recall, they were captured by the KGB and the military. And they were put in the basement for almost about a week. And in that culture, when you are captured by the other side and you're put in a basement, you assume what Nicholas the Tsar got, you'll get. And they were threatened with being assassinated around the clock. Raisa broke down. Raisa just could not handle it. She literally had a nervous breakdown and never recovered from it. Eventually died a few years back. And when she had that breakdown, Gorbachev lost it. And nobody could understand what happened to him. Like, he was this incredibly powerful guy, and all of a sudden it's like he's not there anymore like he used to be. And it's because they didn't know Raisa. And so he was a broken pair of scissors. And he couldn't get up to work. And he ended up being vilified by his own people. Today, if you were to ask Russians, maybe less than, like I say, 8-9% of the Russian people get who he was and respect him. The other 92% hate him. Think he was a traitor. And he'll go down in history, if there is history 100 years from today, if we're still here to read it and write it, he'll go down as probably the greatest male of the last century. Nobody would have done what he did. And Raisa was the essential component without which it could not be done. So, as I said to someone who introduced me tonight, and my wife was in the room, and I said, you've heard that old saying that behind every man is a great woman. And I said, no, actually, it's usually beside or in front. And our job is not to get lost in the shadow. And Gorbachev knew that. So I just wanted to share that story with you because it's one of those unique things I got a chance to see up close that doesn't happen every day and gives you a real interesting way to hold all the rest of the stuff that's about material reality. Okay. Third observation. We are going through right now a clash of civilizations unlike anything that's happened since the last Homo sapiens died about 40,000 years ago. In fact, I'm going to say since the Neanderthals started went on towards extinction about 80,000 years ago. So we're talking about an 80,000-year cycle. Now, before you get scared by this, remember, we've done this. Yeah, we've done this 32 times successfully. So we have done this before, right? We have been able to have one species evolve and not kill off the other species, but just let it die and move on. So no one feels bad that there are no more Cro-Magnon men. They would be a museum piece if they existed. There's no more Homo erectus. Okay? There's no more Homo civilis. There's no more, you can list all of them. And again, there's no more Neanderthals. But most of us thought we were Homo sapiens, and we're not, just to clarify that. We're not. So Homo sapiens died about 40,000 years ago. And Homo sapiens was, the closest thing to Homo sapiens today on the planet Earth is Coco the gorilla in Palo Alto. So Coco the gorilla can tell you, she's got 12 symbols on her keyboard, she can use sign language, and she can tell you if she's feeling ill or happy. She can tell you who's her chimp and who isn't her chimp. So she can communicate in real time, and does. And it's quite an interesting story. If you don't know about Coco, you should follow it. That's what all humans were like up until about 40,000 years ago. That was the best of us. And that sapiens refers to the words, the man or woman who knows, Homo sapiens. Okay? Homo sapiens died out about, and I'll tell you how it died if you want, but and the new species, which all of us in this room pretty much were born into, unless you're under 40, in which case you may have already been born into the new species. But the old species was called Homo sapiens sapiens. That's technically who we are. Okay, people don't know that. It's really an important distinction. Okay, Homo sapiens sapiens is the man or woman who knows that they know. So that means the property of what's called reflective consciousness. The ability to reflect on your experience. Coco can't do that. And neither could Homo sapiens. And that species, Homo sapiens sapiens, which all of us are related to because all of us have the direct lineal descendants of a place called Pinnacle Point in South Africa. It's where every human being on the planet today came from, ultimately. 7.3 billion of us. We all came out of Pinnacle Point. Nobody alive on the planet anywhere but Pinnacle Point, so we know we're all from Pinnacle Point. It's a very interesting story, and if you haven't researched the Pinnacle Point, you should. It's a very interesting story, how few people survived at Pinnacle Point and for how long they survived and how they emerged in what we would call Homo sapiens sapiens. That species, Homo sapiens sapiens, is now dying. It is going to end. The fact that you're in this room, many of you have already voluntarily changed species. In this particular shift of species, like the prior shifts, the key determining factor is consciousness. So the man or woman who knows that they know is a consciousness shift from the man or woman who knows. So, okay. Brain size did not change larger, by the way. What changed was our awareness of who we were and what that meant. The new species, which my good friend Barbara Marks Hubbard and I had this long... Barbara's been like my sister for 35 years. You probably know her around here. Some of you know Barbara? Okay, yeah. So, and unfortunately, Barbara doesn't live here anymore. Barbara moved north. But I've known Barbara literally 35 years as my sister. And Barbara coined a phrase, and she and I had this debate for about 5 years, what we're going to call this new species. And because she's Barbara, she won. I wanted to call it Homo noeticus, and she said, no, Homo universalis. And so we went back and forth, and we argued the properties of noetica versus universalis. And I said, okay, you're Barbara Marx, I'm just Ronaldo. We'll call it your name. So we call it Homo universalis, and you'll be hearing that name a lot more now. Homo universalis. And by the way, if I talk too fast, raise your hand. It seems slow to me, so I need to know I'm going too fast, okay? And then, no, I'm not embarrassed. Appreciate the feedback. Thank you. I should be embarrassed. But, Homo universalis. How is this species different from Homo sapiens sapiens? Well, let's go through it. Homo sapiens, man or woman who knows. Homo sapiens sapiens, the man or woman who knows that they know. Homo universalis, the man or woman who knows that they know, and what they know is that we are one. Homo universalis is the man or woman who knows that they know, reflective consciousness, and what they know is that we are one. So that would be called universal consciousness. Okay? So if you are one, there can be no other. Okay? So a baby dying in Africa isn't a baby dying in Africa. It's you dying in Africa. In a black baby's body. If the planet is struggling because we're choking it, and we become an infection to our own biosphere, it's because we forgot that we are one with our biosphere. Okay? So when you see the clash of these two huge forces now, a human civilization that is dying, and by the way, will die no matter what. Homo sapiens sapiens cannot be saved. It will, just like you can't save Neanderthals when their time came. So this new species, Homo universalis, which is probably everybody in this room because we chose to go to that place of universal consciousness. We chose to go to the place of believing that we are one. And then we looked at data which confirmed that. And for those of us who are not sure yet, that's okay. You just haven't decided which species you're in. And that's okay. And by the way, these things are not pretty usually. Species die-off can be a very ugly thing. And I was talking to my friend Clint this morning. I said, you know, the number one responsibility of all Homo universalis, whether you were born that way or you chose to become Homo universalis, the number one responsibility is to lubricate the transition from one species to the next. Make it easier for people to get there. Reduce the suffering, if you can. If we can reduce the suffering, then those who don't choose to ever stop being Homo sapiens sapiens can at least live their years out in much greater comfort than they would if they're left to their own devices, which will be more war, which will be more terrorism, which will be a collapse of society as you know it, and which will be a termination point for human civilization as you know it. And that's all going to happen in less than 35 years, just to give you some idea of the speed. And if you want, we can talk about why that number is important. Probably less than 30 years. So if our job, therefore, is to assume if we don't get active, human civilization as we know it will end in an ugly way. In one of the chapters that I was asked to cover, Stephen touches on the fact that hundreds of millions of people could die from climate change. It's one of the things he's wrong about. It's actually billions. And I can tell you where they're going to die first, and I can tell you how they're going to die, and I can tell you how fast they're going to die. And it's billions, it's not hundreds of millions. And I want you to think of what I just said. Thank you. If we're talking about billions, so 7.4 billion people on the planet, and if we're saying that billions of them are going to die in conflict, do you realize what that means for even those of us who are Homo universalis as this conflict sweeps around us? We don't choose to be casualties of this conflict, but we will be inevitably swept up in it unless those of us who are old enough, probably me, are gone before it happens. Even in that case, to fail to act, to me, is a moral imperative. I have children. I have grandchildren. They will not escape. And I don't want the dystopian future which awaits them to happen if I can lubricate the transition so that we can get to the place where this level of destruction does not have to happen. Why am I mentioning this? Because, and I do a radio show once a month. It's on, I've never erased one of them, so you can hear what I said 3 or 4 years ago. You can hear what I said 2 weeks ago. I never erase a radio show. If I was right, I was right. If I was wrong, I was wrong. I'll stand by what I said the day I said it. Fortunately, according to my audience, I've been primarily right, which makes them very happy because I give a lot of financial advice for free. What I've been saying on that show for quite some time, and what I brought to a head on September 17th, was I said, I've finally realized that the United States of America is not having a presidential election. That is not what's happening. And I need to share that with you. because on the simplest level, I don't, and I hang around with some of the best business people in the world. I just got to spend a day and a half with my good friend Paul Pullman, who runs Unilever globally, one of the largest companies in the world. I have many billionaires who are close friends of mine who are extremely successful in business, way more than I am, because that was their goal. My goal wasn't to be successful. My goal was to get things done. But I'm not complaining because I did surprisingly well for an itinerant monk. But the reason, you know, it surprises me. I really does. It surprises me that a guy like me has got two nickels actually at the end of this parade. But of all those business people, there isn't one of either party of any consequence on Wall Street or in corporate America that supports Donald Trump. Not one. And, yes, thank God, and every single one of them is petrified he'll get elected. And every single one of them does not consider him a businessman. That's a package he sold everyone. He is an entertainer. He's a reality TV show star. He couldn't operate a business if he had to. Every time he's tried, he's failed. People quote that he went bankrupt four times. That's not true. He went bankrupt six times. Two of them, he was able to refinance his way out of by floating more debt. And four of them, he hit the wall and never came back. In all six cases, his partners and his banks got badly wounded. And in all six cases, he came out on top. He is not a businessman. He tried to run an airline, Trump Airline, ran it into the ground. He doesn't even build buildings anymore. He puts his name on them. He's a licensing organization. What he sells is his brand of Trump. Now, why am I bringing this up? Because if that's what it was a business, a television huckster, a con man, masquerading as a business person, then I would say, okay, it's an election. And hopefully the American people will see through that, and hopefully they'll elect the right people, and you know, hopefully they'll realize that if everybody on Wall Street, everybody in corporate America thinks this guy's a nut job, they'll somehow come around. And I kind of resented, as a business person with scruples and morals, that he had gotten to that level of the game. And then I had this revelation about two, 3 weeks ago. Oh, my God. This isn't about a presidential election. This is a clash of cultures that's so massive. It really is the two paradigms colliding. He represents the shadow of Homo sapiens sapiens. And Hillary represents what the future potential is of the new feminism. Okay? So, I have a number of companies. I started one of the companies I started in 1981. It's called Doerrison Corporation. And the charter of Doerrison Corporation reads as follows, and I can have no trouble reciting it verbatim. Doerrison Corporation was formed to serve the emerging feminine aspect of the divine at this time on the planet. That's what Doerrison does. That's how I ended up doing a lot of things I do. Because I knew back in 1981, that was the big shift. I didn't know what it would look like on the other side of the paradigm and looking back at Homo sapiens sapiens. But I knew that somehow the divine feminine was what was going to emerge that was going to help us transition. So now, as I looked at the race, theoretically a race of two people for president, I realized why I was so upset, and I was really churned up, that on one hand you've got someone who is clearly a racist. You know, he's his campaign, the three top officials are run by Breitbart. Breitbart is the self-declared home of the alt-right. Alt-right is the well-accepted definition of white Aryan nation. So white supremacy is what the Trump campaign's about. That's what it's about, white supremacy. And if you want to hear how they view their candidate, they did a press conference in Washington, D.C. just 10 days ago, in which they were very clear why they supported Trump and why he supported them. They proceeded to explain that blacks have an inferior intelligence, and they gave a number for it in IQ, that browns had an inferior intelligence, but slightly better than blacks, and that whites, as a superior race, needed to go back to racial purity. Now, the last time I heard that was 1936. And the guy who said it had a funny little mustache. And at the time he took the Reichstag, he only had 35% of the population. but he was elected. Okay? And the people around him, particularly the corporate interests, thought he could be a tool to be used for corporate gain. And so they supported him. In this case, fortunately, we've evolved enough that the business interests are saying, wait a minute, this guy's going to crater the economy, which he will if he got elected. So when you look at this racism, white Aryan nation on the one side, Hillary, as a teenager, saw a speech by Martin Luther King that so inspired her that as a white girl from a Republican white girl from Chicago, she went to the South to work on voter registration in the civil rights movement. She became friends with Marion Wright Edelman, who was probably one of the most articulate proponents of the rights of black children in American history. Marion Wright Edelman. Edelman, E-D-E-L-M-A-N. So you go, that would be enough right there to say there's something bigger than the presidency going on. But then you look at the idea of what started Trump was the birther movement. The birther movement. He was the leader of the birther, that Obama was not born in America. Okay? And what was that about? Well, he was testing a theory. And the theory he was testing, he could get people to respond out of fear of other, the other. This black guy from Kenya. And it was a racist dog whistle, but it was more than that. It was a test for him to see if he could turn people away from a black man just because he was a black man with the audacity to run for president. That's how he gets started. And after he badgered the president into releasing a short form and then ultimately his long form birth certificate, which he released in 2011, for 4 years after that, he continued to challenge the legitimacy of Barack Obama as president, even though there is no question any whatsoever that he was born in Hawaii. Of a white mother, by the way, and a black father. A white American mother raised by progressive white people in Chicago, actually.
He was American no matter where he was born.
Yes, well, you could take that case, but stay with the birther thing. So when he learned that, he said, gee, this other thing worked pretty good because I picked up a lot of support. That catapulted him into politics from being a business person, TV star.
Why do you think he wanted to do it?
Because I think he wants, I think he's a sociopath.
Yeah.
And I think, and that's that conclusion is the exact literal conclusion of the man who wrote the book for him, Art of the Deal, Tony Schwartz. He said he's a sociopath. Someone said, God, that's a strong term. He said, look it up in the dictionary. It fits. Okay. So what he did is when he started the formal campaign, he said, I'm going to attack brown people. It worked last time with black people. Let's go after brown ones. And he put out this outrageous anti-immigrant diatribe about they're coming across the border to rape our women and they're all carrying drugs and on. Now, not any rational, sensible person could possibly look at that and believe it. You really can't. I mean, first of all, America has had net out migration of Hispanics for the last 3.5 years, meaning more are leaving than are coming, just for the record. So if there's no way you can rationally come up with that position, how do you get there if you want to support that position? You get there from touching into your own shadow, your own sense of alienation, your own sense of, I've got to fear the other. And that's what Homo sapiens sapiens does when it gets scared. And what Homo universalis does is it says, there is no other. We're all one. So we don't solve this for me at your expense, we solve it for us. Well, that's a different issue and a different subject for a different time. I mean, I think that's a great question. How does Hillary get this across? Interesting question. But I'm just trying to deal with something even bigger than a presidential election. And what I'm saying is, and I could go down some other chains. How do you see the way Homo sapiens sapiens organizes its business affairs, which is basically not principles agreed historically? That's how the world got here. Homo universalis says, wait a minute. If I take from you to benefit me, I lose too. So the only way the business can work is if it works for everybody. That's the hallmark of Homo Universalis. There's a book some of you may have read, maybe back on that table, that Barbara Marx did in 2012 called Birth 2012. Have any of you seen that book? Okay, if you get a copy, and what she did is she asked 12 of us to write short chapters in that book. Because the 12 sections of the wheel, she calls it. And so the wheel has one of its sections is called business. And so that's the one she asked me to write. So I wrote a very short chapter. This is back in mid-2012. And the chapter was called The Ascent of the Phoenix, in which I wrote that the capital system that you know is going to crash of its own weight continuing on this path. And the and predicting that doesn't make me a genius, it just makes me observe it. The better question, I said, is what replaces it? What does the new economic system look like? And in that very brief few pages, I described that. And that's why I called it The Ascent of the Phoenix. As you recall, the Phoenix crashed and burned, but it was the ascent, the reemergence from the fire, which is the heart of the story of the Phoenix, the mythical bird. So what I wanted to share with you is, and I could go down other things besides sexism. Obviously, he's a misogynist. I mean, obviously, there's a huge percentage of America that wants to turn the clock back, particularly white, undereducated males. They want to be able to look down on black people and brown people. That was the world that they controlled. They want to keep women in the kitchen. If they could take away their vote, they would. They want to control women's bodies. They want to basically disadvantage women in the workplace. So we're not just talking sexism, we're talking about a clash of cultures. The culture of Homo sapiens sapiens, which is coming to an end and out of fear, is now going to its darkest side, to alienation, to shadow. On the other side is Hillary. And she's representing, and I'm not suggesting that she's a saint, although I'm a big fan of Hillary. I do not view this as the lesser of two evils. I think one is this incredibly capable person, probably the best and most talented person that ever ran for president of the United States, is Hillary Clinton. I believe it. So we can talk about that later if you want. I'll be happy to talk about it anytime. But that's not what I'm here for. I'm here to use her as a metatype. I'm talking about the feminine running for president. I'm talking about not Donald Trump, but the shadow that wants to turn that clock back, not just on feminism, but on inclusiveness, on integration, on equal rights for all, on the end of trickle-down economics, which is incredibly insane. So these are two paradigms that are clashing that are bigger than an election, because they're clashing at the precise time that two species are changing. And that's why it's so combustible. So if you wonder why so much is combustible, it's because of this, it's the magnitude of this transition. And so when I read a book like Sacred America, what I'm really trying to tune into is what's the spiritual dimension that's missing. That if we were to create that spiritual dimension in two fashions, one, literally, to be inspired in the Greek sense, right? To breathe in. If we choose to be inspired, in that sense, the sacred, and in the sense of the sacred being that which is the highest we know we are capable of and we can embrace. The highest we are capable of and that which we can embrace. That's the sacred when it comes to work in the world every day. And when you run a company that way, it looks radically different than a company that's run on the old principles. When you run an educational system, it looks radically different. When you create a transportation system, it looks radically different. When you create a banking system, it looks radically different. So what I'd like you to look at as the rest of the time we've got together is look at the possibility that what the three chapters I'm going to blow through here in a second are about is something much more fundamental than these three chapters. And the word sacred is more fundamental than the idea of genuflecting to some god. It's about a different level of the sacred. And because there is every time the species evolves, there is pain. It's like birth. A new species is being born. And as you know, the process of birth, under the best of circumstances, is painful. It can be dark. It can be messy. At the end of it, please God, it works out okay and everybody's happy. But you go through this very dark, dark challenge. And fearful sometimes. Now, that's what's ending, and it will end. And there will be some people left who will be the new species. How many? I don't know. I hope a bunch. And they will then create the world of Homo Universalis, just like Homo sapiens sapiens created his and her world. And what this book is about is some ideas of how that new world can look. So, it's about conscious evolution. As Barbara would say, it's about choosing, because this time we don't have the benefit of millennia to adapt. We have to choose now. And what we have to choose is to engage actively in the lubrication of this transition. It is not an acceptable moral position for me, not that I'm going to go check on anybody, to stand by neutral in the face of this level of challenge. So, I believe there's 1.25 billion children today without adequate water on the planet. That's not acceptable. 1.25 billion children are without adequate water, meaning clean, adequate drinking water at their disposal at this time on the planet. To say nothing of food. 2.6 billion people live on less than a dollar a day. Okay, so we could keep going down that line of statistics, but I'm trying to avoid that because the issues are so much bigger. I said to Clint earlier, you know, everybody in this room.
Break time.
Okay. I said to everybody in this room, it's break time.